Hello there. Welcome. It is Eric Erickson here, the Eric Erickson Show across the nation. Hello, all of you listening online on the stream. I'm just stunned every day. If you are just happen to stumble across me and you don't have me on the radio where you are, you can go to ewerickson.com and get the live stream, the 24-hour stream. You can see all the stations we're on. We're about to add a few more there. It'll be good as we grow. Now, do you have a Ring doorbell? I need to set the stage for this. A couple of years ago, well, it's been more than that now. A few years ago, we had a group of men show up at our house on our doorstep to threaten me in particular, harass the family. We've had people come by the house in the past. We've had activists of all kinds, left and right, show up at our house. And I mean, it wasn't that long ago. I was in my front yard. Someone rode past, started yelling, "Stop the steal!" at me. On weekly, once a week, sit on the front porch with a friend of mine, Philip, and we have bourbon and cigars, typically on Sunday night. Occasionally we'll have other people over. Sometimes it'll just be us. You would be amazed at the number of people who drive past my house slowly. And for a long time, Philip never really understood why we let our bushes grow up so high in our front yard. And now he realizes there's a reason. I don't want people seeing me on the front porch. People who come by and everyone's very nice. You know, I was talking to a famous person the other day who told me that she has noticed that the people who like her are the ones who are most likely to want to come up and talk. It's the people who don't like her, glare at her, scowl, but they don't say anything. And in my experience, that's true. Very rarely do I have someone who comes up to me who dislikes me. I was at the mall one time and a guy came past and said, "Eric Erickson." I said, "Yeah." And he was from San Francisco. And he says, this was back when I was on CNN. So this would have been 2012, 2013. Guy said, "Gosh, I can't believe I saw you in person. I'm actually from San Francisco. Disagree with everything you say, but you just seem like a nice guy. Wanted to say hi." Thanks. Usually it's the people who really like me. They want to come up I'm learning more and more of the people who are actually friends with a guy on radio as opposed to people who are my friends. They talk in different ways. But we have people drive past our house all the time. One day when I am successful in radio, hopefully, and have handled my budget well, I will buy land and build a house and you won't be able to drive past my house. We'll have lots of guns and lots of places to bury the bodies of the people who come arrest us. But as all of this is happening, we move into this house. I'm on CNN at the time, moved to Fox News, and my wife starts hearing about Ring doorbells. And she's like, "Maybe we need a Ring doorbell." And for those of you who don't know, a Ring doorbell, it's been bought by Amazon now, and it has a camera on it so you can see who's at the door. And we now have camera systems all over our house. We don't have a Ring doorbell. And Ring, a couple of years ago, I just thought it was very creepy. And I'm skeptical of Amazon and Google typically with their invasions of privacy. It's one reason I stay with Apple. They're less likely to, Siri isn't snooping on you and the like your Amazon Alexa. Although I have one of those. Someone gifted me an Amazon Alexa when they first came out. To this day, I have no idea who sent it to me. We've got it. It works. It tells the kids jokes. It runs a timer, can turn on and off the lights. We've got a lot of Apple stuff in our house, but I don't have a Ring, and I didn't want a Ring because the Ring to me, given it's behind the scenes stuff, it didn't seem secure. And then Amazon bought it and it started doing this deal with the police where they would just allow the police access to the Ring camera. And so you could see if somebody was, if a house was broken into, the police could access all the Ring cameras in the neighborhood. But the Ring doorbell is actually highly popular. There are a bunch of people in my neighborhood who have them, and you can see them when I'm out for a walk. You notice that people have Ring doorbells everywhere. We're one of the few in the neighborhood, it seems like, who doesn't. But did you know that if you have one, you're a racist? Did you know you're a racist? I mean, I'm sure you knew you were racist because nowadays everybody's a racist, but oh, I wish I was making this up. The Washington Post is profiling a guy you've never heard of, Chris Gilliard, who is a professor at a school you've never heard of, Macomb Community College. And you will note, by being at a community college, the odds are he's not that great of a professor, but yet he's gotten a social media following, and that makes the media pay attention to him. And in fact, now he's declaring the ring racist. This is the Washington Post. In Ring, a doorbell video camera that can send footage to your phone and broadcast it to your neighbors, millions of American homeowners see an affordable way to gain peace of mind. Chris Gilliard, a community college professor raised in an aggressively policed Detroit, sees something quite different. A tool of old-fashioned racial profiling dressed up in a sleek new package. A Ring camera offers, quote, an opportunity for people to broadcast who they think should and should not be in a particular neighborhood, end quote, Gilliard said. He went on to say, and often what that means is folks saying that certain black people or black people in general should not be in their neighborhood. Far from academia's elite institutions, Gilliard, 51, has emerged as an influential thinker on the relationship between trendy tech tools, privacy, and race. From the phrase digital redlining to the phrase luxury surveillance, he has helped coin concepts that are reframing the debate around technology's impacts and awakening recognition that seemingly apolitical products can harm marginalized groups. While some scholars confine their work to peer-reviewed journals, Gilliard posts prolifically on Twitter, wryly skewering consumer tech launches and flagging the latest example of what he sees as blinkered techno-optimism or surveillance creep. Among his aphorisms, automating the racist thing is not going to make it less racist. It's an irony of the world Silicon Valley has constructed that an otherwise obscure rhetoric and composition teacher with a Twitter habit could emerge as one of its sharpest foils. That's it. That's his deep thought. Automating that racist thing is not going to make it less racist. These are his deep thoughts. He has a Twitter following, therefore you must pay attention to him because he will unleash the mob on you. That's apparently it. With 25,000 followers on social media and coining the phrase digital redlining. Y'all, the Ring doorbell is not racist. It does give people peace of mind. And frankly, with crime on the rise, probably you need to have a camera at your home to document the person who's stealing the package off your front porch. But we're in this age where everything now is racist. And anyone who wants to claim something is racist gets a media following to claim whatever it is racist. And the media puts these people on a pedestal. If they're on the left and they think something is bad, you can be sure they're going to get a media profile that's going to be a fawning profile of them because the media already believes it. Or the media wants to believe it. Or the media feels it needs to absolve itself of some white privilege. So it highlights a guy like this who causes outcries over things like a doorbell camera. Why? Because someone may call the police and say, there's a black kid in my front yard. Turns out it's the neighbor's kid, and they just haven't bothered to learn who their neighbor is. And so, obviously, they're a bad person, allegedly. Or maybe they just don't know who their neighbor is, and they should take the time to learn who their neighbors are. It's just the idea that it's racist is a problem. What it is frankly, I think these cameras have contributed to the surveillance state, and Amazon's loosey-goosey privacy on this stuff makes it all worse. But screaming racism about technology, screaming racism about the Google algorithm is a little bit silly, and it's happening more and more. But let's take the Google algorithm. So Google, if you were here on Friday, was it Friday? I interviewed Lila Rose. Lila Rose is at Live Action. And Live Action was running ads on Google for women Googling Plan B. I did not know this until Lila was explaining it to me, that there are two medications you use. One stops progesterone, which can kill the baby in utero, and then the other causes the abortion. And if you take it in time, you have regrets, you've taken this pill, you can take a different pill that restarts the progesterone and saves the baby. And some women, not a lot, but some, have second thoughts, don't want to go through with the abortion, and want the cure. And so Live Action and other pro-life groups have been advertising on Google so that women who are searching this drug can actually see that there are ways to undo what you've done prior to the abortion. Google, because of activist outcry on the left, has blocked the advertisement. We hear all the time now these days that black people who work at Google believe that if the algorithm is not shaped by black people, you will not hear black voices. We hear all the time, minorities at Google, that if you don't have gay people, transgender people, black people, Hispanic people, whoever, helping write the algorithm, that Google will all the time focus on the patriarchy, the cisgendered hetero Christian patriarchy, and all the resources, the first hits will come up with white people. Never mind, the Google algorithm is supposed to bring up the most authoritative articles first. According to these people, these activists, some of these people who work at Google, that if you don't have black people, brown people, gay people, transgender people, whichever non-white male person you want working in the algorithm, that they'll be blocked or they won't come up first or they'll be biased. But keep in mind, these are the same people who believe this about the Google algorithm and don't want conservatives to participate. In other words, they believe that they should be able to suppress conservatives on Google. And in fact, Google's leadership seems deeply hostile to conservatives and is perfectly happy to stop Live Action from advertising, is perfectly happy to block conservatives. But a camera is not an algorithm. And the technology is not racist. It's just technology. It's a tool. Do you use the tool in a racist way? Maybe so. In the post-Civil War period of the United States, rope was sold in the South. The rope was not racist, but racists would use the rope for wicked, awful, evil things. Did not make the rope wicked, awful, and evil. It made the people using it in wicked, awful, evil ways, wicked, awful, evil people. The same way with a doorbell camera. It is not racism to have a doorbell camera to make sure that it is documented when someone steals a package off your porch and the police get a facial recognition shot of that person. That's not racism. It is not racism when you see someone walking down your street and that person clearly does not belong, is soliciting, is knocking on doors. It's not racist. It's racist if it's your next door neighbor's child and you haven't bothered to figure out or meet or know or build a relationship with the black person who moved next door to you and you couldn't care less about them until you want to call the cops on their kid because you see them on the Ring doorbell camera. That's a problem. It's not the Ring's fault, though. It's not the doorbell's fault. It's your fault because you're a terrible neighbor. And yet we're in an age where the inanimate object becomes the bad object. Why? This is the important point here, because the inanimate object is the proxy by which people on the left can blame for their own sins, including racism, instead of having to take ownership for what terrible people they are. These are the people who give the Emmys to all white people and then lecture you on Black Lives Matters. These are the people who are insistent it's the pervasive use of the Ring doorbell camera that's racist, not them. Not the way they see the world. The inanimate object becomes the sinful thing because it's a proxy for them to avoid having to blame themselves. And that's what you need to know. And when the media starts highlighting that technology is racist, oftentimes it's the people in the media who are trying to distract you from their own problems. David Ignatius is a liberal writer. Where is he? The Washington Post, New York Times. He was on Morning Joe. Listen to this.
The reason this is important, Joe, is it goes to the core thing that Biden is selling the world, selling Americans, which is that this is a competent administration. It doesn't make mistakes. It rebuilds alliances. It solves COVID. It goes right to the problem. It knows what to do. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the fixers after the breakers of the Biden, of the Trump administration. And I think that's why last Friday, the series of things that Jonathan Lemire listed hurt so much, is because it goes to this core competence issue, which Biden's got to make more believable to Americans, but also to the world.
That is the problem. Going full circle to the first hour, the Biden administration continues to screw up everything. at the White House press conference. It's happening while we are here right now. Jen Psaki was asked if the Haitians crossing the Rio Grande are having to show their proof of vaccine card. And she said no. To get into this country legally now from somewhere else, you have to show you've been vaccinated. But if you want to walk across the Rio Grande Dam and come in from Mexico, you don't have to show you're vaccinated. Now, what's the difference? She says, well, they're not planning on staying long term. They're not planning on staying long term. Actually, they want to come here and not leave. But the European who's hopping a flight to go to Disney World, he intends to leave after a week or two. It makes no sense. They've screwed this up. They have screwed up so much. And the media is starting to realize that if they don't do something quickly, they're going to have problems with voters in the midterms. This is Julie Pace of the Associated Press.
Julie, President Biden was, as we say, already in trouble with the American people and the way he's handled Afghanistan. This tragic mistake with this drone strike is not going to increase public confidence in his handling.
No, it's certainly not. And it is just a really horrific tragedy that this strike killed civilians in Afghanistan, including people who had worked closely with Americans during the course of the war. In some ways, it's almost a fitting end to the real mess that we've seen in Afghanistan in the closing weeks of the U.S. presence there. And I think one of the things that the White House, you know, has kind of struggled to get their hands around here is the idea that actually the public has largely been supportive of the notion of getting American troops out of Afghanistan, but they have increasingly become frustrated and angry with the way that that drawdown has happened. And so the ultimate decision to leave may be seen as the right one by many people. The way it was handled continues to, I think, really to frustrate again and anger a lot of Americans. And I think the question going forward is, what does the situation on the ground in Afghanistan look like in a few months?
Yep. And that's Afghanistan. This is John Carl. On COVID.
And John, I want to start with you. The FDA committee's recommendation on the booster was more narrow than President Biden wanted. You heard Anthony Fauci's explanation of that, but he is being criticized for jumping the gun. What happened?
Well, it looked like the White House was getting ahead of the science, that the White House was getting ahead of the health experts. And, you know, Dr. Fauci seems to be in a little bit of a spin mode and saying, look, we were just wanted to be ready by this date. But make no mistake, Martha, when the White House rolled this out, the expectation was you would begin the process of boosters for everybody on September 20th. That was not the recommendation of the FDA advisory panel. It will not be what the FDA goes forward with in all likelihood. And this is important. Because Biden's credibility on COVID has been what has driven his level of his popularity. I mean, this is what he is trusted most on and what he needs to be trusted most on. And we've seen it eroded over the past several weeks.
For a whole lot of reasons, which is one reason he decided to blame the unvaccinated people and express his frustration with the unvaccinated people as opposed to owning the situation, because he can't. And they're not going to. And this is going to have a real world impact on the Biden administration overall as the midterms rapidly approach. We're still more than a year away, but the dynamics are starting to lock in. And those dynamics are not very favorable at all for the Democrats. And it's even having effects in gubernatorial numbers, which raises the question of people like Beto O'Rourke and Stacey Abrams running. Well, don't look now, but as of this writing, as of this moment, the Dow is down 884 points. The NASDAQ is down 478 points. The S&P 500 down 116 points. Another bad day on the market. Why? Well, part of this is because of Evergrande. And Evergrande is not alone, but Evergrande is a pretty bizarre situation dealing with China. If you want to understand why the markets are down, though, there is profound instability in China. The Chinese government has essentially been cooking the books to cover it up, and they can cover it up no longer. It is going to provide and produce such instability in China. A lot of people, frankly, are worried the Chinese are going to try some sort of military event in order to distract the people of China from the economic turmoil, because the Chinese have moved in a very nationalist direction, and it is not beyond the possibility that Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, would do something to distract from the calamities his communist regime has allowed to happen. Evergrande is a major financial train wreck that is playing out in real time, costing the markets. I want to read for you some tweets by Sahil Bloom. He deserves credit for this. The Evergrande Group is a Fortune 500 real estate developer with headquarters in Shenzhen, Guangdong, China. It was founded in 1996. It is a big business. As recently as 2020, it had sales of over $100 billion and adjusted core profits of around $5 billion. At its core, it's a home building business in China. Its website states it has over 1,300 projects across 280 cities. But it has pushed the boundaries, making investments in electric vehicles, an internet and media production company, a theme park, a soccer club, a mineral water company. As a developer, Evergrande had to contend with a highly cash-consumptive growth profile. Building a new project may take many months and requires a lot of cash outflows along the way. Cash collection from buyers come later, with the exception of smaller upfront deposits. So how did Evergrande fund its impressive growth? Debt. It borrowed aggressively, even by real estate property development standards. It became the world's most heavily indebted developer, with a debt load of over $100 billion and over $300 billion in liabilities. As is pointed out by someone else on the internet, there's a bit of moral hazard created along the way. Evergrande was largely indifferent to pricing on the land it was purchasing in China, knowing the risk would be passed off to the banks financing the purchases. It's a common practice in these construction companies, the game Evergrande excelled at. It bids on land at prices significantly higher than the market. It didn't matter to them because the risk gets transferred to the banks that financed the project. The debt-fueled growth propelled Evergrande and its now billionaire founder into an elite class. It entered the Fortune 500 at number 496 in 2016 and reached 122 by the latest ranking. But debt is a double-edged sword, and Evergrande was due to catch the other edge of that sword. As its debt burden grew, so did the interest payments on its debt. This is mostly fine so long as revenue and profit continue to grow. But if the growth or profitability slows or government restricts borrowing, well, it's not fine anymore. Imagine a metaphorical boa constrictor tightening his grip around you. You can try to borrow to make your payments, but if you borrow to make your payments, that just fuels the strength of the snake wrapping around you. Moreover, the knowledge of your precarious position increases risk. It makes the borrowing more challenging and costly. In Evergrande's case, the snake tightened its grip in 2020. It had its first major liquidity scare, a potential inability to meet its liabilities, sending a letter to local governments in China warning that upcoming payments could cause a crisis with systemic financial sector risk. As with most deleveraging spirals, there's a technical side, an inability to make payments, and a psychological side, the knowledge of instability impacts your market standing. The psychology is damning. Reports of the letter sent Evergrande stock and bonds tumbling. The short-term crisis was avoided, but the long-term remained. Crises that take longer to happen than you expect, but happens faster than you ever could have imagined. This proved true with Evergrande. To meet its ever-growing obligations, Evergrande began tapping into creative financing strategies. Now, ask yourself, if you wanted to creatively finance for a company, what would you do? Get on TikTok? Get an OnlyFans account for the corporate board members? You know what Evergrande did to creatively finance and keep it going so it could pay its bills? It pushed its own employees to provide short-term loans to the company. It called them high-interest investments, in order to ensure they received their year-end bonuses. So if you didn't contribute to the company, you didn't get your year-end bonus. But the company fell behind making payments back to its employees. It had over $7.4 billion in bond payments due in 2022 and large interest payments coming up this coming Thursday. The crisis is accelerating, and the psychological side is as impactful as the technical. It was recently reported Evergrande was offering to sell properties at a deep discount, indicating a fire sale required to make its payments and send further panic spiraling into the market. Protests have broken out at its offices in China. Up to 1 million home buyers are left in devastating limbo. They paid deposits up front for homes that now may never be built, and Evergrande doesn't have the money. The media narrative is just causing even more problems. It's going to cause a problem to the Chinese economy. They've got deep ties to financial institutions and working class consumers, already going in a system where the Chinese economy appears on the verge of collapsing, even as it tries to come out of the COVID situation, which China now says is going to last longer. That's has a lot to do with why the American stock market today is in a free fall, down over 800 points as of now. The Evergrande situation was allowed to get out of control, not by American regulators, but by Chinese regulators. It comes at a time that the Chinese are showing other profound bits of market instability. And in so doing, it's having a direct effect on your 401k here in this country because of the Chinese regulatory irregularities. This is yet another economic downturn coming out of China. The same country that caused the virus caused an economic downturn, and it's coming again because the Chinese wanted its own real estate companies to become as big as possible, to dominate the world, to get into the Fortune 500 so that American regulators and bankers would have to deal with them. Thankfully, most American banking institutions stayed away. It's the Chinese who are on the hook. But Evergrande still has connections into the American market system, which means it still negatively affects us. And the larger question here, this is a question I don't have the answer to. I don't know that anyone has the answer to this. It's not just Evergrande that is dealing in moral hazard. Now, what is moral hazard? There are a lot of ways to explain it, but essentially, when the government sets up a company to live consequence-free, it creates a moral hazard whereby the company continues to live consequence-free, knowing that someone else will have to take the loss for it. So, for example, the American government, after the 2008 market freefall, bailed out a bunch of companies that should never have been bailed out. Those companies continue today. What did those companies learn in 2008? The wrong lesson. You get so big that if your failure would disrupt the economy, the government is going to bail you out. So make as many risky deals as you can to get as big as possible as quickly as possible so that the government, if something does come along, the government bails you out. I've got a number of friends of mine who work on Wall Street, some of whom work for private equity, some in hedge funds, and they all tell me this is a latent problem for our economy that we don't even realize because after COVID, the American government bailed everybody out. Now, Kelly Loeffler from Georgia, when she was a U.S. senator, I had her on the show, was talking about this, and she agreed it's a moral hazard, but also said that the Congress, frankly, is not smart enough to move quickly enough to be able to figure out who they should and should not bail out. So we're going to have to bail out everybody, and then we're going to have to do our due diligence to see who really we should have left to go bankrupt. But there wasn't enough time to do that. We had to save the economy immediately. And I don't think she was wrong. I actually think she was right in this. But we haven't now taken the time to go back and figure out the moral hazards that we've created and the companies that we've sustained that should go bankrupt. And this is happening in China on a massive scale. This company is massive in its debt. It is massive in its reach in China. Over 280 cities, over 1,300 projects, millions of people, but with a debt load of over $100 billion and over $300 billion in liabilities, and a whole lot of people who paid down payments on homes yet to be built. And they're not going to get their money back. And they're all in China. And who are they going to blame? They will blame first the company, and they will blame first the CEO, but they will start to blame the government regulators who let it happen. Chairman Xi, President Xi, he's going to have to find someone to scapegoat so it doesn't come back to him. But then there will be ripple effects into this economy. As the Chinese economy slows down, our economy inevitably will slow down. And what happens when our economy begins to slow down again? Which companies in our economy that were propped up by the government, moral hazard created, which ones will start to crumble? And then will the government go back in and try to prop those companies up again? I don't know the answer, but I can tell you, you and I are going to be left holding the bag. The elite in this country who caused these problems clearly never want to hold the bag and never want to be responsible. And that's going to cause a whole series of other problems and a big bag of hurt in this country as you and I get left holding the bag for a bunch of people who refuse responsibility and want a government bailout. People are not going to, in an era with where we COVID, we're now managing it, where we've been through the crises, people are not going to want to put up with this stuff. It doesn't end well for a lot of these companies who are so used to the government bailing them out. At some point, you become so big that you have to fail, or the American taxpayers are going to riot. And I think we're at that point. Now, I don't want you to riot about the messy, smelly air in your house. There's a solution. It's the Eden Pure Thunderstorm. And right now you get three of them and save $200. What you do is you go to EdenPureDeals.com and you'll see my name, Eric Erickson. You click it and you'll see the Eden Pure Thunderstorm. It's an air purifier. It's filterless. You don't have to buy a subscription to air filters like you do with printer ink cartridges. You just buy the air purifier and you get three of them and you save $200 and you get free shipping by going to EdenPureDeals.com. Click on my name. Put the Eden Pure Thunderstorm in your cart. You'll see the buy three offer. Click it. Put it in your cart and then click the orange checkout button. You'll see a discount code box. Put Eric3, Eric and the number 3. There's no space. You don't write out 3, just the number, E-R-I-C-K, the number 3, no space. And when you click that discount button and you click the apply button, you will take $200 off and you'll get free shipping of the Eden Pure Thunderstorm. Clean the air in your house. Get three of them, one for upstairs, one for downstairs, one for the basement or the RV, wherever you want to take it. They're highly portable, highly effective. You'll really like it. Go to EdenPureDeals.com. Click on the Eden Pure Thunderstorm after you followed my name through, and then the discount code, Eric, and the number 3. This hour of the program brought to you by First Liberty Building and Loan. Wherever you are in the nation, they want to help your business grow. If you're in charge of the finances of business, you need a loan, reach out to First Liberty Building and Loan. They make their own decisions. They'll help you get yes where banks say no. Just spend 10 minutes with them. See if they're a good fit. We're talking big deals, six figures and above. Go to FirstLibertyGA.com. That's FirstLibertyGA.com. Buddy of mine texted me. He's listening to the show in New York City. I always like that Pace Picani ad. He's listening to me online in New York. He's that one of the private equity guys I was telling y'all I'm friends with. And he said, it's not just the Evergrande situation that's causing problems and turmoil on Wall Street. The Fed's meeting, and people are getting nervous about what the Fed might do. Will they raise interest rates sooner than expected? And also the financial situation in Washington. Now, he tells me this. He says that a lot of people are nervous about COVID. But the COVID situation, it's really kind of into the market already. The real one, though, is the Fed meeting. Evergrande is big because that's going to have a ripple effect across Asian markets and the real estate industry. But then what about what happened in Washington, D.C.? The Republicans are refusing to go along with raising the debt ceiling, and the Democrats are going to have to figure out how to do it themselves because Republicans are not going to do it with them. Meanwhile, Kyrsten Sinema has all but killed the infrastructure deal in Washington unless the bipartisan infrastructure deal is passed. Now, this is real key here. Kyrsten Sinema, the senator from Arizona who replaced John McCain ultimately, it's his seat, she's in, she decided that she would go to the White House and say, if the bipartisan infrastructure deal does not pass by September 27th, she will kill the Democrats' reconciliation plan. She'll join Joe Manchin. And Joe Manchin has said he won't have more than $1.5 trillion added to it. The Democrats in the House, the progressives, say you either give us the $3.5 trillion or we're going to kill the bipartisan deal. So now you got the Senate saying you give us the bipartisan deal or we're going to kill the $3.5 trillion. You got a, what is it? What do they call it? Circular firing squad, a Mexican fire squad. I can't remember what they call it, but I mean, the Democrats are shooting at each other now. Forget the Republicans. Meanwhile, the Senate parliamentarian has come out and said, sorry guys, You can't put amnesty in the reconciliation package. You can't do it. Now, anyone who knows anything about reconciliation knew that this was going to happen. Reconciliation has a provision. Reconciliation is where the Senate majority can pass a budgetary matter that impacts the deficit and debt without having to worry about the filibuster. But one of the rules is that you cannot add major policy changes to it, even if those major policy changes have a positive impact on the budget. And the Senate parliamentarian ruled that immigration is a clear, the amnesty is a clear, distinct policy shift. And as a clear, distinct policy shift, you cannot put it in reconciliation. So amnesty is dead unless the Senate Democrats vote to overrule the parliamentarian. And the odds of them voting to overrule the parliamentarian are really slim to none at this point because they don't have the votes to do it. It's kind of shocking that we're at this point, but it was foreseeable that we would get to this point. The Democrats have to follow the law. The law says you can't do this. So the question is, will they go along with the bipartisan infrastructure bill or not? House moderate Democrats have concluded, from what I'm told, that they would rather no infrastructure deal than the big one. They actually think that if you pass the big reconciliation package, that's $3.5 trillion, they'll get attacked for it in advertising, and it'll cost them their seats. So basically, the House progressives are the ones on the hook now. They either pass the bipartisan bill, or they're the ones who decide there will be no infrastructure, and they desperately want infrastructure. They just want so much more, and they're not now going to get it because of Kristen Sinema. She's basically thrown the ultimate monkey wrench in, along with Joe Manchin, who says he'll go along with the reconciliation package as long as it's no more than $1.5 trillion. Sinema says if they don't pass the original infrastructure bill first, she's going to kill the whole thing. Sinema's going to wipe out the entire Democrat agenda. Joe Biden may actually go down as the least accomplished president ever. I mean, worse than Jimmy Carter at this point because he can't get anything done. Who would have thought the COVID bailout at the beginning of his administration was the biggest significant thing he's done? That may be where he is, and a one-term president at that.